Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, Roma Agrawal, the structural engineer whose work helped build Western Europe's tallest building, the Shard. She'll be here to discuss the heights of her career and new book, Built, the Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures.
We'll also be hearing from the singular musical phenomenon, Ryuichi Sakamoto, whose collaborators range from David Bowie to the cream of the current dance music scene. We'll be discussing his new album and past career a little later.
And we'll be talking to photographer and artist Paul Graham. He'll discuss why his photo book Essential, A Shimmer of Possibility, is still revealing new glimpses of American life a decade since its release.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be shedding very little new light on next week's news stories. And we've got music, of course, too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What else would anyone be doing at noon on a Sunday, Andrew, but being here in cosy Studio 2? We've kind of decamped to the smaller, warmer, more warmly lit Studio 2.
This is the kind of bedsit version of the two studios. But I quite like it. It takes us back to our student days, Rob. Yeah. I went this week to Lisbon with Carlotta Rebello from Monocle 24. Or as I discovered when we got there, she's not called Carlotta Rebello. She's called Carlotta Rebello. Yeah, there was a whole kind of like different pronunciation going on. We had a good time and we went to a conference about sound in the city. Listen to that, but it was one of the nicest shows we've done for a long time. It was some really kind of nuts people who make audio art and sound art, sound sculptures and all sorts of things, through to people who are engineers. And as we're going to hear later on in the show, the world of engineering is fascinating. These are people who... they go in and make a concert hall, and how you make a perfect concert hall is kind of crazy. So it was a really interesting week.
Did you make a lot of noise? Was it okay?
We did make a lot of noise, and we also collected a huge amount of noise, which when we came back to London, we got David Stevens, who works in the studios here, to remix into a bit of a kind of a Lisbon rap.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know who we need to now sort of elbow or lure in with a can of Tennant's Super on the end of a bamboo cane. It's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry, yeah. Love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop.
But how am I doing now?
Everything is all right.
Hi, Henry.
In this year, the centenary of the granting of at least partial voting rights to women in Westminster. The first woman to hold the title of Black Rod in the 650-year history of the post is going to be formally introduced to the House of Lords. Do you know what Black Rod is, you two?
Black Rod is symbolic of the monarch, right? And he gets the doors of Parliament slammed in his face now in a ceremonial way to show the difference between church and state, and it harks back to Charles.
Presumably. And then he bangs on the door to come in.
Yeah, to be let in.
That's there, indeed. Yeah. No, that's what she and or he is best known for, is the opening of Parliament, where, as you mentioned, they kind of ceremonially knock on the door, get it shut on their face, then get it opened again. But they also take care of arranging other ceremonial aspects of life from there. But no, we're going to have the first female Black Rod. She will be formally known as Lady Usher of the Black Rod. She's called Sarah Clark. She's previously held roles at 4 Olympic Games, the London Marathon, and most recently worked as Championships Director at the All England Lawn Tennis Club. They do Wimbledon, don't they? Yeah, it'll be interesting to see that. Between the 24th of February and the 4th of March, the Salon d'Agriculture is taking place in Paris. Do you know what that is?
It's where kind of lots of cabbages and carrots get together and kind of discuss the future of, you know, politics and philosophy.
Indeed. It's kind of like a Parisian literary salon, but with vegetables. No, it's not. It's a French agriculture trade show. And Emmanuel Macron's turning up. And it's controversial that he's turning up, or he may face controversy when he turns up, because among the many reforms that Macron is trying to introduce to French society broadly at the moment, is an overhaul of French farmers' relationship to EU funding, more specifically the Common Agricultural Policy, of which French farmers are the main recipients. And it's always been a really big issue for France in Europe, this provision of subsidies to their farmers through the EU system. Macron thinks it's outdated, it thinks it's not serving French farmers very well. France also, I think, for the first time in recent years, is now paying more into the Common Agricultural Policy than it's getting back. Moreover, French agriculture represents a less and less significant component of the economy. But
French as farmers, you know, from a British perspective, a fairly feisty bunch.
Very
and uniquely
feisty bunch.
Kind of left wing as well, actually, right?
Indeed. So they have a track record of dramatic and disruptive protests, it says on my notes in front of me, including burning hay outside government offices and hounding ministers and lawmakers across the country. So as militant as, let's be honest, many French unions,
yeah,
they don't pull their punches. And these ones have got tractors too.
Yeah.
So you've got to look out for them. Yeah. So good luck to Macron dealing with that. and finally, also this week, the Conservative Political Action Conference is taking place in the US. This is a really weird event that there isn't really an analogue for, either in left-wing US politics or in British or European politics that I can think of. It's both the kind of a political conference where people discuss, you know, policy, conservative lawmakers can get together. But it's also kind of like a flashy media event. Donald Trump attended last year, Nigel Farage attended last year, and this year I think he's going to come as well. There's really high production values around it. It's not just a kind of wonky think tank. They try to make it sexy. There's been some interesting controversy this year because perhaps counterintuitively, CPAC, the organisation, rescinded its acceptance of a pro-family conservative group called Mass Resistance, and it's allowing a Republican LGBT activist group called the Log Cabin Republicans to stay, which obviously is somewhat out of tune with, I think, what is perceived to be the symbolic direction of the American conservative moment.
Is it an olive branch? It seems like it might be sort of a...
Could be a fig leaf, couldn't it?
We're nicer than you think. That was a very, very good news. Look at that. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Rob.
When we look up at the towering structures such as architect Renzo Piano's The Shard in central London, we're only really seeing half the design picture. Much of what allows gravity-defying towers like these to stay up and in one piece is down to the talent of engineers, whose work helps bring an architect's vision to reality.
Roma Agrawal is a structural engineer whose new book, Built: The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures, explains how engineering allows design to flourish. And she's perfectly placed to tell that story, having worked on high-profile projects such as The Shard herself. Roma, welcome to the programme.
Well, thanks for having me.
So first things first, we mentioned The Shard a couple of times in our introduction. It's a building that excites opinion. What does it feel like when you've worked on something so famous and something that's beginning to be iconic? What's it like when you walk inside one of your structures?
It's the best feeling in the world, to be honest. That's why I'm an engineer. That's what engineering, I think, is about. It's about the creative design process. It's working with people. And then at the end of it, you have a beautiful structure that you can go and visit. And there's not very many professions where you can say that. You get something really, really tangible at the end, which loads of people are excited by.
And yeah, and of course, and I suppose, as we said, you know, it's a building that excites opinions as well. That is sort of, does that matter to you at all? Is it nice to be a part of something that everyone's got an opinion on that obviously is a big deal on the horizon and the skyline?
Well, I mean, I think it's really exciting because people are really inspired by it. It gets people talking, which is amazing. You know, for me, it's about the engineering. It's about the amazing, technically complex stuff that we've done. But the thing that I really enjoy, so I often take trains into London Bridge and I will often see young kids kind of glued to the windows going, oh my God, yeah, it's The Shard. And they just love it. And that's really, really lovely.
As I guess architecture has moved out of the world of modernism and, you know, angular squares and nice neat shapes and into this new world of architecture where we think of the likes of, you know, Zaha Hadid or Amanda Levitt, you have these incredibly sinuous, organic buildings, which is very easy for an architect to kind of scribble on a piece of paper. But it's people like yourself who have to make it a reality. What is that tension, that discussion between architect, you think, and engineer? Is your job to say, yeah, we can make this? Or is your job to say, maybe you need a few more straight walls?
So I like to think that my job is about, yes, we can make this, because it's a process, it's design, we get together, we discuss stuff. So we're iterating all the time. So there will often be times when the architects say, oh, I really want to do this. I might think, ooh, that looks challenging, but I will try and go and find a way to do it. And I think with all these curvy, sinuous shapes that we're talking about, computing has really, really opened up the ability for us to do that. So in some ways, it's the tech, the engineering that has then allowed for architecture to kind of open up its wings and go for these, you know, different shapes that we just haven't seen in the past few centuries.
Now, in your book, you have a series of nice illustrations and designs showing how the kind of basics of engineering, why things stay up. Again, when you come back to contemporary buildings that you're often involved in, they're using new materials. They're trying to create spaces where the trick of what keeps it up isn't so obvious. You know, we're talking about buildings where pillars and big walls are being taken away for huge spaces. What is that down to? Is that down to a better understanding of, you know, how weight moves around or how things are held up? Why can we now make these more adventurous spaces?
Yes, so these, again, come down to computing, I'd say. So we have a better understanding of materials, how they work, what kind of stresses and strains they feel, how they might move. And then these really kind of complex computer programs allow us to actually model the entire structure in 3D, and we can then simulate different things. So the wind, for example, will change, and we need to look at how that affects lots of stuff. So because we now have so much more understanding of the materials and where all the forces are going, thanks to computing, we can then, you know, slim down our structure as much as possible. So the skyscrapers that were built in the kind of 19th and 20th centuries in New York, for example, have a lot more material than the buildings that we're building today. So it is slowly evolving. And I very much see kind of engineering as this evolution over time of, you know, you start, you'll have these kind of amazing blips of ingenuity and innovation that kind of push you forward. But you overall get this kind of lovely graph of progress that allows you to build the kind of structures that we do today.
So we are perfecting it, because a lot of people, not just the exterior, not just the look, the exterior look of buildings, but structurally, people kind of go, there was a golden age in the 19th century, and with certain designers and engineers like Brunel and stuff, people are fans of their work. But I suppose part of your job also is, if you're doing your job properly, no one can quite see what you've done.
Yeah, and that's one of my challenges.
Yeah. Sort of the invisible discipline, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges. I think that's one of the reasons people don't know about engineering so much anymore, because when it works, and you don't hear about it. You do hear about engineering when things go wrong. So I always say that the time I hear about the word engineering in the public is when I'm standing on a train platform and there's delays, and then they'll say, oh, it's due to engineering works, which is kind of ironic, because they're saying engineering works, but then that's delayed your train. So and that's the only time you kind of hear this this concept of engineering. So that's why I wrote the book. That's why I go out and talk to people and try and promote what we do. Because as you say, Brunel was a big showman. People knew him. He was politically active. You know, he was out there talking. And people really kind of appreciated the work that him and, in fact, his father did. But at the moment, engineering seems to have taken a bit of a step.
Do you think it's has the reputation of engineering changed because we don't have perhaps these big public, you know, we know the architects, as Andrew was name checking a few of them at the beginning of our interview, but the engineers less so. We know Cecil Belmond and Arup and these sorts of people, sort of, if you're in that world, that's a big name,
right.
And yourself, of course.
Of course.
But do you know what I mean? Do you think engineering, the reputation has suffered, or sort of there is a fame deficit somehow?
I think there is. is a fame deficit, as it were, and I think maybe science in general has it. You know, we start to see the Brian Cox effect of, you know, amazing television or David Attenborough out there about biology, about physics. And we need to bring a bit more of that, I think, with engineering. So, you know, Grand Designs does a great job of talking about the engineering in the structures and, you know, as well as the aesthetics. But yeah, I definitely think that we could do, you know, with a bit more public facing, you know, this is how awesome engineers are. Because I only talk about one tiny bit of engineering, whereas actually I know engineers that are designing spacesuits, that are designing bits of the Mars rover, that are designing robotics for people, you know, for amputees. And so engineering really touches so many different aspects of our world. And, you know, I think we all need to know a bit more about it.
Now, the book has many roles, because it's not just talking about engineering, but you know, you're obviously addressing the issue of women within the industry. And you tell the story of the Brooklyn Bridge through a series of accidents and fate pushed a woman to the fore, maybe for the first time in a long time, in the world of engineering. Perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about that story and why you're fascinated by this character.
Emily Roebling is really one of my heroes. And I think the reason I admire her so much is, you know, as you say, she was pushed into this situation. It's not something that she planned. She had this family legacy that she wanted to protect. So her father-in-law was this illustrious bridge builder in the US. He was a German immigrant. He dies in an accident on site, or you know, an accident on site leads him to getting tetanus, and he dies. Her husband then goes to work in these caissons, which are these chambers that they sink right to the bottom of the river to build the foundations. They didn't understand the bends at the time, so he keeps coming, you know, up and down through the water, and essentially almost gets paralyzed and is very, very ill. So now the bridge is going to be taken away from the Roebling family, and Emily kind of steps in, and all she does in the beginning is take notes from her husband. She wants to download his brain, as it were, before, you know, she thinks he's going to die. She starts there. She's soon writing letters. She's soon studying the complex cable theory, the engineering that's required. She's working with the labourers on site. But at the same time, she's also dealing with all the politics, because there's two different cities, Brooklyn and Manhattan, as they were at the time. They're asking why people are dying on site. The Roebling family is getting sued for various things. They want to shut the project down. It's, you know, there's all these problems going on. And you have this woman. And, you know, at the time, women were believed to be intellectually inferior to men. And she steps up and she basically covers all of these different aspects. And that's what engineering is. It's about the technical side, but it's also about people. So she really embodied that spirit of an engineer without ever having any qualifications.
And how much
what
is
a great
your
hero to have? What a specific and great hero to have. And you're right, it's the politics of it as well, right?
When Washington was asked what Emily's greatest contribution to the build was, he said her talent as a peacemaker, because he knew that if she hadn't gone and smoothened out all of these different issues that were happening, that bridge would never have been built.
And how much are you today an exception to the rule, and how much has the industry changed to allow women to today flourish?
So at the moment, in engineering in the UK, less than 10% of engineers are female. And then the numbers for ethnic minority people as well is very, very low. I think that's below 5%. So there is definitely a dearth of people from different backgrounds going into the profession. Now, I've been around for about 12 years and I have seen a change. So, you know, in my very early days of going on site, there would be pictures of naked women on the walls and I would have to go in and have serious conversations about engineering. I have not seen that in the last 5 or 6 years. I've definitely seen more women based on site. They actually have women's toilets now, which is a bonus. So,
well, know, that's the last thing to happen, you know.
things are moving on. We're getting more women studying engineering at university. But what happens is we're basically losing women at every stage. So at GCSE science, we lose them. At A level, we lose them. At university, we lose them. And then obviously not all the women that study engineering go on to be engineers either. And that's disproportionately true for women compared to men.
And why didn't you drop out at any of those stages?
So I grew up in a few different countries. So I was in the US for a bit. I was in India for most of my childhood. And I think culturally it's very different. So in India, I think the aspiration for most parents is that their kids become a doctor or an engineer, because we perhaps see that more you know, live effect of how engineering's making society better firsthand. So that was very natural for me. It was a very, very normal, natural choice. And I only really felt, wow, I'm in a minority, when I started my degree in physics at Oxford, where probably about 10% of this huge lecture theatre was female. And I just loved it. So, yes, I faced barriers for different reasons. I had a physics degree, then I'm trying to become an engineer. That created barriers as well. But I just really, really wanted to do engineering, and I found a way to get there.
And being women going into sites and working on these big projects, is that your heroine? Do you feel that is a helpful political thing?
So
that it smooths things differently.
I think people react to me differently. So people are often surprised. They don't really know what to expect. I say in my book that people swear a lot in meetings, but they'll always then look at me and apologise without realising that I have a bit of a potty mouth myself. But they assume because I'm a woman, I'm going to take offence to this. So it does kind of change the dynamic and the atmosphere of the room when different people come together. And I think that's a good thing, because I think different people bring different perspectives, and that's really important because we design for society. And in terms of the kind of the big skyline and the big projects, I just think that's a very human aspiration. I think human
reaching
beings...
Reaching for the heavens, kind of thing.
Yeah, we want to go into space. We want, we've done the moon, we've done the ISS, we now want to go to Mars. So we're always trying to break the next record and build the next biggest thing because we can.
And on that world of what's possible, when we think about these huge buildings that are going up, there is this every year there seems to be something taller than the year before. What is the limit for engineers when they think about height? Because I guess there are the limitations of whether you can. We've spoken in the past to lift companies. First of all, it seems that the lift is the challenge more than the engineering. And then there's the humanity question: how disconnected you feel when you're sitting so far up. But for engineers, what do you think is the potential limit on how high you could build?
So talking from a purely engineering perspective, someone used to always say to me, "We can do anything. How much money and time do you have?" So theoretically speaking, we can build a tall tower, almost as far as we could, we want to. But it's not the engineering that's going to set the limits to what we actually build. It's going to be things like time, cost, and then what we want to actually achieve and what, how we feel about it and so on. And again, I think that this is such a cultural thing because, you look at cities like Hong Kong, even Singapore, Manhattan, and people are very comfortable living in high rise. In Europe, we're less so. So that's why I find it very fascinating that most of the tallest buildings in the world that we see are in China, are in the Middle East, because I think the cultural context plays a huge role in what they decide to build.
So it's fascinating. It's not just the the tension of steel or the load bearing nature of concrete. It's cultural elements that come into play with engineering as well, which we think of as being more of a kind of a pure science.
That's right, because for me, engineering does bridge that gap between a pure science, but what we're doing is for people. Ultimately, we are people making things for other people. So we could make stuff that is not really what people want, and that wouldn't really be a successful structure.
So, Romy, before we let you go, you do a lot of work with younger people who are trying to get into this world, and you've talked about your journey. What do you think are the kind of key things we need to consider when getting young people into the world of engineering?
So I think young children are naturally so curious about the world. They're always asking, why? How does that work? Breaking things, trying to put things together. So there's a very, very natural curiosity that kids have. So the trick for us is to make sure that continues. Part of that is inspiring teachers. It's about parents supporting that curiosity throughout as well. And for me, when I go in to talk to young kids, It's almost fairly simple. I just tell them what I do. I just talk about my work. I tell them about the buildings I do, the different materials I use, and they're absolutely fascinated. So in some ways, the job is easy because our work is interesting in itself, and that's what we need to tell them about. I think what's harder is the fact that people see the sciences as difficult to score high grades in, for example. They see it for the brainy few. But that's not true. I think anyone that's got an interest and a will and, put in a bit of hard work, and you can really, really succeed in any science subject.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Roma. And Roma Agrawal's book, Built: The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures, is out now. And you are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly. Time for something new now. We'll be discussing American life on camera with the photographer Paul Graham at the end of the show. So staying loosely on topic, this is new from former Pavement man Stephen Malkmus with Middle America.
That was Stephen Malkmus there with Middle America, and you're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're going to be hearing more music and discussion in just a moment with Ryuichi Sakamoto.
Japanese musician, soundtrack composer and experimentalist Ryuichi Sakamoto has been an incomparable presence in music for over 40 years. His work ranges from his early beginnings in Tokyo band Yellow Magic Orchestra to progressive electronic sounds such as last year's Async album. And in between, he's created stirring scores for films such as Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, The Revenant and The Last Emperor, the latter of which won him an Oscar, and collaborated with everyone from David Bowie to David Byrne.
His latest record is Async Remodels. It's a reworking of last year's release with contemporary electronic luminaries such as Finesse, Survive, and the late Johan Johansson, adding to the original's ambient tunes. Recently, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Ryuichi about the new record and some of his career, and he began by asking how he picked his collaborators for the new album.
In the past 4 or 5 years, I've been listening to those artists quite a lot. Maybe half of them are pretty much like ambient sort of kind of music. So I thought my album, I think, would inspire those artists in some way. I wanted to see their responses, their reactions to the album.
Do you thrive on that back and forth? Because you mentioned that about, you know, these are the actual artists you listen to, and, you know, you might have had an inkling that obviously you've been influential on them. I mean, does that still inspire you today, that back and forth, that conversation in music?
I think so, yes. My concept for collaboration is I would like to work or collaborate with someone who has a different skill and ideas and talent than my own. So I would expect something, you know, I cannot do by myself. So obviously that's the inspiration in between artists. And that's what I wanted.
Going back to the very early days of your career, was that present in your very first collaborations just with, rather than, you know, these international artists which you've worked with in the future, when you were putting together Yellow Magic Orchestra with your fellow bandmates? I mean, do you feel like the Yellow Magic Orchestra sound was something that you could never have created on your own? Or do you think that the band members were absolutely part of what you guys kind of came up with in the end?
The Yellow Magic Orchestra, it's like a person, you know, another person, you know, not Sakamoto, not Takahashi, or not Hosona, but it is itself as an artist or a person. You know, obviously it's a band, but you know, not 100% my Sakamoto, or 100% of someone else. But it is an individual artist, and the. Naturally, you know, I couldn't do it by myself. I couldn't make that kind of music by myself.
And tell me a little bit about the scene that that band emerged from, because I saw you guys do an interview where you were very humble and you said that Kraftwerk and Giorgio Moroder were pioneers in front of you, and you guys maybe thought that maybe you were somewhere third behind them. But I think today a lot of people would maybe try and put you all in a similar bracket. What kind of sounds were inspiring you back in the 70s in Tokyo?
Definitely the punk music was very popular. There was only kind of an underground scene in Tokyo. We were influenced, but we didn't play really the punk. But right after punk, there was a kind of a new wave movement coming from London. We were so heavily influenced by this after punk new wave. It's not pure Kraftwerk or Giorgio Moroder, but it's a mixture of the kind of synth music of the 70s and, you know, mixed with the London new wave, new kind of music. That's what we wanted.
One of the performances which I think people really enjoy watching now that we have YouTube and things to be able to track down these performances by Yellow Magic Orchestra is your appearance on Soul Train. People find that surprising, I guess, just because perhaps music from Japan just wouldn't be expected to end up on that show. Can you tell me how that performance came about, and was it a surprise to you, or was it something that you felt was destined to happen?
The eve of forming the band, Yellow Magic Orchestra, you know, we were talking about the dance band, the R&B band, and we thought we were the best number one Japanese R&B band. So that's one issue. And the Kraftwerk, you know, pure techno is second, and new wave. So all mixture. Mixture is the trend, what probably tendency or the very popular tendency of Japanese culture. So we wanted to do that. And so unexpectedly, the first single, which is Firecracker of YMO, was a hit in Atlanta or somewhere, you know, in the R&B chart. So we were very excited, and we were called by that program, Soul Train. So we were so happy to be there.
In case you folks out there in television land are wondering what's going on, I haven't the slightest idea. But you fellas have a great sound. I know we have a slight language barrier here, so let's get some hands together, gang, for the Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Moving on, I mean, when you started to make solo records, how did you make that transition from making maybe records that were geared towards dance clubs or punk clubs or even the pop charts? You found yourself making soundtracks. I mean, was that something that you were always aiming to do, or was that something that sort of materialized out of some of the circles that you were running in?
Starting to write film music was like an accident. I was asked by the director to act first his film, Mr. Oshima, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, with David Bowie. I was asked to act, but I wasn't trained anything, you know, at all. So when I was asked to act by the director, I asked the director, you know, for me to write music for it. Suddenly, you know, the idea came to my mind. So I asked him, and he said immediately, yes. That's how I started.
You and an artist like David Bowie's timeline, I mean, you grew up in the same period, and you've switched between genres in myriad ways. I mean, I think that there's a bit of a duality between those two careers. Was David Bowie, when you worked with him, was that someone that you perceived as a superstar and you were looking up to him? Or did you see a little bit of yourself in him, in how he worked?
No. I wasn't that silly to compare myself to David Bowie. But, well, I met him and then we started shooting in a very small island in the South Pacific Ocean. And during the shooting for 2 months, he was very down-to-earth, nice guy. So we talked and we spent almost every evening. Then the shooting was done. We reunited at the Cannes Film Festival and he acted like a superstar and I was a bit shocked. He's a very intellectual guy and we were in a kind of similar generation. And he was a bit older than I am, but we shared something, you know, in time.
One of your traits is that you never seem to stick to one discipline for too long. But I read a really nice quote from Roddy Frame from Aztec Camera, because he was saying that people listen to your music and they hear all of these atmospherics and maybe strange qualities. And people sort of assume that that's all to do with technology and synthesizers and stuff. But he says that it's all in the writing and it's all in the composition and that these atmospherics, they could probably appear on any instrument that you play. Tell me a little bit about how you put your music together. Are you going for melody? Are you going for textures? Are you going for feelings? What's the most important thing for you?
Well, Roddy Frame is such a nice guy, and that's a great compliment. The unique atmosphere is not coming from only the keyboards or kinds of synthesizers or the particular timbres. But I think it's coming from inside me. That's kind of related to the Japanese-ness, Japanese culture, or Japanese sonority, I guess. It doesn't mean, you know, all the Japanese musicians or, you know, players have that quality, but certainly it's kind of Asian or Japanese, maybe. And as I get older and older, I want to have more spaces between the notes. So spaces, those spaces not purely vacant. It has a special atmosphere in between notes. That's what I want to express right now.
I think that's something that's very prevalent in your soundtrack work. And obviously, that is something that people making films would be seeking. They'd be seeking someone who can find like a subtlety in the quiet moments as well as the big bombastic moments. What are some of the soundtracks that you are most happy with, whether that's because you simply like the music or you think that it really served the film in the best way?
I haven't got 100% yet. I'm always frustrated what I do, but that's the driving engine for me to go forward. So that's good. But, you know, I'm quite happy with the result of the Revenant. Also, I'm happy with the music I wrote for Little Buddha, which is the third time I worked with Bernardo Bertolucci.
Coming back to the albums, I mean, when you made the first iteration of Async, what was informing that record? Because obviously you had a break. I mean, were you looking to make a certain type of album or were you processing simply what had gone on in your life and the end product was whatever would come out of that process?
I might be strange, you know. I want to make something I cannot expect. I always want to surprise myself. So this time for a sync. In the beginning, I didn't know what to do. So I was looking for what I wanted. And it took me 4 months. That's a long time. Every day I was doing something. I was recording some sounds of many things, including in the room, but outside also. I went to an upstate one night, a few of the recordings. So I was doing many different things in 4 months. And after 4 months, I decided to make some imaginable soundtrack for Tarkovsky film.
Okay.
So that's the theme.
Yeah, interesting.
That film doesn't exist.
You mentioned the time period that it took you 4 months. I mean, every artist works in different ways, but you mentioned that as being a long time. Do you tend to find that you work quickly? Are you a quick worker, or do you keep coming back to things and changing and changing and changing?
I have been mostly always quick decider, decision maker, and you know, very quick composer. You know, it sounds good, you know, that's it. But not this time. I doubted. You know, I doubted myself. I doubted what I was hearing. So that's why I took time.
What do you think was driving that sense of doubt on that record?
I doubt the formal grammar or forms or vocabulary of music. Those are decided by someone else, you know, in the past. So I didn't want to use any of those. I purely want to create something new by myself, 100%. I don't know why I wanted to do that, but that's how I did it.
And I also read a quote with you, Ryuichi. When you were finished, although, I mean, you had this difficulty trying to make something that you felt was sort of almost brand new, when you did finish it, a thought occurred to you that you like it too much and you didn't want to share it with anyone else. Is that something that happens to you a lot? Do you get to the end of the process and just think, this is mine, I want to enjoy it for a little while longer on my own?
Well, this is the very first time in my life, you know, I got that feeling, you know, I really liked too much. And if you met a princess in a fantasy, probably you don't want to share that, or jewelry or something else, you know, really, really valuable for you, you don't want to share it. Something like that. The very first time happened.
When you were making Async remodels, or when you were going through the process of with others of helping to make it, was there a criteria for the people that you worked with, or was it simply those who you really had been listening to yourself?
There was no criteria. I worked with somebody who made the sounds, you know, I wanted to hear, or they can make sounds which I cannot. So that's simply that.
And what's in the future for you? Are you working on any new projects?
Well, something, you know, I got by making Async is so valuable. So I wanted to develop from Async toward the future. And right now, I'm thinking to write an opera, probably in 2 years or so. It's a development of Async, but as an opera.
Ryuichi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
That was Ryuichi Sakamoto speaking to Tom Hall, and his new record, Async Remodels, is out this week. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. The British photographer Paul Graham's work uses documentary-style images to capture scenes many might not feel are immediately iconic. He's renowned for using techniques such as multiple shots taken in quick succession to show subtly evolving moments, or using the bright light of overexposure to simulate that feeling of being startled in the street. These moments happen every day, but assume an unusual resonance under the focus of Graham's camera.
His set of books under the title A Shimmer of Possibility first appeared in 2007, focusing on scenes in Graham's adopted home of the US. It sold out almost immediately and has been hard to find ever since. Now Mac Books are releasing a new version of the photo books, and Paul joins us on the line from New York to discuss why these images still hold such intrigue. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Paul, and perhaps we should ask that very simple question straight out, because we were looking at the images today, me and Robin, we were saying how much they still resonate now. Maybe a decade has passed since you took them, but they still seem to perhaps even more speak to an America that we didn't quite understand in the US election, that seems slightly unknown to us in a way.
None of the imagery is about topical things. So it's interesting that you say it still has a resonance, you know, because obviously the situation has changed dramatically in that it's almost exactly a decade since the books were first published. But because they are not relying on newsworthy moments, newsworthy incidents that date very quickly, it's off nominative life, everyday things like someone cutting the grass or getting some shopping back, bringing some shopping back from the store or waiting for a bus to come. Very everyday scenarios. It doesn't age, and there is a quality to it that hopefully will transcend the moment of time which it was taken, you know, and speak over a number of years.
I guess the bit I was trying to perhaps badly kind of edge my way into is that I guess for especially for people outside America, but many people in America as well, are you normally transfixed by very simple images of America from Los Angeles, from the cities we know. There are so many icons that get photographed again and again. And these seemingly inconsequential moments depict maybe people who had often been outside of the normal glare of the camera. And maybe that's part of the political narrative of the recent years, is that a feeling that there is a whole lot of America that doesn't come into focus for photographers, for the media, for all sorts of people in that kind of normal tumult of the day.
It's both the people and the geography of it are slightly different. It's not cliche deep inner city, New York, Manhattan, or Vegas, or anything like that. Neither is it rural America, neither escaping that. It's this sort of inconsequential suburban sprawl and post-industrial America. And people likewise. It's not the rich and famous in the cities, and neither is it the celebrated, you know, Trump aficionado, or the equivalent of that, what that would have been 10 years ago. It's people who are quietly living their lives in that very large gulf, between those two extremes, which the great majority do live in. They live their life in those lands, in those homes, going about their lives in everyday fashion, as I described earlier, with no outrageously strong views either way on politics or the state of the nation. You know, people just trying to survive. As one person once referred to me as, just described himself as doing the struggle dance, getting up every day and doing the struggle dance, which I thought was a beautiful expression.
And that's something, Paul, that you capture, that idea of the poetic nature of the ordinary somehow. You've talked eloquently before about the ideas of what you need to wield a camera in earnest are an understanding of light and time and consciousness. This was in a video interview we were researching earlier on. And I wondered whether you're conscious all the time, whether these photographs, seems like a funny thing to ask an artist, whether essentially they turn out like you hope they're going to, or whether you find something always in the chosen frame that is accidentally beautiful or accidentally has something of nobility or surprise about it.
A bit of both. You sometimes find things that you weren't expecting, that things spring up just through working again and again and again, and beautiful surprises happen. The wonderful thing about photography is it's this dance with life itself. You're out there with this equal partner, the world, itself. It's not entirely under your control. It's not you with a blank piece of paper typing out your novel or you with a blank canvas painting a painting. You have this infinite world out there that you have to struggle and wrestle with to grapple something meaningful out of it, out of the flow, you know, the infinite flow, the infinite world. That can be surprising. So occasionally you think, you know, you go out there sometimes, you think you know exactly what to take a picture of, and the world, you know, it will be perfect when you've done it, and you go out there with your camera and you work, and the world just slaps you in the chops and says, nope, no way, not interested in collaborating with you on this, it's not very good. And at the same time, you sort of slump back and wander off down the street, and then something beautiful occurs.
And do you, putting out photography books, you mentioned the sort of democratic thing about it, and obviously the price point, which makes it that. Are you interested in talking to the people that love your work, Paul, about why they love it, or does that kind of let the genie out of the bottle sometimes? You know what I mean? I sometimes wonder when the artists walk around the private view of their show and they overhear what people are talking about. Obviously, you're preaching to the choir, I suppose, if you know someone's bought and enjoyed your book. But are you keen to hear people giving a bit of a criticism in a positive way, your work, trying to uncover the meaning of it, or at least the meaning of it for them?
It's radio. I'm smiling while you're saying that.
I can hear you smiling. It sounds good.
I mean, yes, if it's positive, and I don't mean positive effusive. I just mean if it's criticism meant in a positive spirit, of course one's interested in hearing that. And it's also interesting to know what people pick up on and have run with in your work, which may not be what you thought was the most successful part or the intention of the thing in the first place. But if it's positive and, you know, I guess that's the one rubbed off of me in America, not to be a mopey old sod in the sense that, you know, my father was a Northern British man and he could be sometimes.
Don't be offended when people are saying it's great, you know, yeah.
Yeah, that's equally vacuous. Yeah. An intelligent, smart criticism, yes, it's great. And the surprise has been, going back to the early books that you mentioned, is I first released a photography book on the A1, the Great North Road, in, I think it was 83. So whatever that is now, 35 years ago. And it's amazing. I was in Norway last week, and, you know, someone said, oh, here, would you sign this? And they bought this book and they lived in Northern Norway, you know, 30 something years ago. And it's phenomenal. You realize the reach of books and the durability of them. If I'd had a spectacular exhibition at the Photographer's Gallery, it would have been up and down, you know, in 6 weeks. But the book is out there reaching people in foreign countries and still has a meaning for them.
We will forever be asked, what is the best way to approach Peterborough services by people in Norway? Paul, congratulations on the reissue of A Shimmer of Possibility. We didn't even have time to talk about the amazing names, The Whiteness of the Whale, the poetry. You are predisposed to poetry by the naming of your books and exhibitions and stuff as well.
That one, yes. I hope it comes across it's intended slightly. There's a hint of positivity about that, you know, the shimmer of possibility within everyday life. You know.
It's a beautiful thing, capturing amazing poetic moments. Paul Graham, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I enjoyed that edition of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew. Let's hope everyone else did too. I feel like being in one of the two hot seats was a nice place to be this week. So this time next week, we're going to be gearing up for our Monocle Media Conference in London.
Which I looked at yesterday, and there was just like literally half a dozen tickets left. It's an afternoon event, which we did last year. It brings together lots of people with positive stories to tell about the media, everything from John Batzek, who you're going to be interviewing about the future of the documentary, just Thomas Lindner, who's coming over from the Frankfurter Allgemeine to talk about, you know, here's an amazing German media brand that has changed at its own pace and has found success by doing both new things and old things. It's going to be an afternoon of real challenges, and then afterwards, there's a drink, which is always a good thing.
Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and researched by Louis Harnett O'Mara and Stephanie Sikia, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Week will be back same time, same place next week, for the time being from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.